Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron rugby. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. Find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. At this time, I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Jerk, welcome to the show this evening.
Now, Captain, good to be back.
And I'd like to start off the show tonight, unfortunately, on a somber note. And yes. For those who have not heard and talk different chat rooms past week, longtime football card collector, football memorabilia collector, a gentleman who had a great love of the American Football League and the San Diego Chargers, a friend of the hobby, a friend of Gridiron Greats Magazine, one of our original subscribers.
Yeah.
Welcome, Mr. Paul Howard, passed from several health issues that he had for the past couple of years. And just to lead off, two stories. I've known Paul since roughly 2008 when I took over the magazine, and very dedicated to the magazine. He enjoyed reading it, gave me some feedback way back when on the magazine, which I try to follow and listen to him about. But my claim to fame with Paul was the 2016 Atlantic City National Convention. Paul stayed, we both stayed at the Tropicana, and he was a few rooms down from my room on the same floor. So the first two mornings we were there, we went downstairs for coffee, a donut or a roll or whatever we did. We talked football, talked about a lot of different things. And in the old days, we were members of another chat room, and they had their annual dinner on Thursday night. And we were at an Italian restaurant in Atlantic City. And I remember we were on the third floor of this restaurant. There was no elevator getting up or down, so you have to walk steps up and down. And Paul had a few pops. I had a few pops. And Paul says to me at the end, will you walk me home? I said, sure, Paul. Now you got to picture this. For those who don't know me, I'm about 5'8". Paul was what, 6'4", 6'5"?
He's taller than me. I'm 6'5". Yeah, he's a big boy.
All right, so he's 6'7". All right, so he's probably got a foot on me, and he's got at least 60, 70 pounds on me. So we're walking now Atlantic City from where we went up to the Tropicana there. It was probably a good 7-8 block walk, and we're leaving, and I said to Paul, I could call a taxi, Paul. We could just get a taxi up the street here. And he says, not at all. We're going to walk. It's a nice night. So we're walking up the street, and I'm basically praying we don't get bugged or whatever going up there. But get into the lobby mercifully and get to the elevator. And I still remember there was a bellhop in the elevator, and I gave him the floor, whatever the floor was. And he says, do you need any help here? And I said, no, we'll be fine. And Paul's trying to make conversation with the bellhop, and I'm like, holy mackerel, I don't believe this is happening. So we get out, and the guy says again, he says, I can help you to get him in his room. I said, no, we'll be fine. So I get Paul in, and I said, you need any help, Paul? He says, no, I'll be fine. He says, I'll meet you for coffee tomorrow morning like we did. And I said, okay. And sure enough, you could set your watch. The next morning, I'm opening the door, and who am I looking at as I'm coming out of the room is Wolfie. He's all dressed. He's all ready. He's just ready to go. And I said, I was hoping you were going to be here, but I'm hoping you're going to be here, Paul. He says, yeah. He says, we're going to go down for coffee and get something to eat. He said, I'm fine. And then and he says, thanks for walking me home. I said, well, good. I'm glad you remembered at least what was going on. And
that was fun.
But that was a classic. That was a classic. I will never forget that as long as I live. But I feel bad.
I think Wolfie would enjoy us telling stories of him and laughing. I mean, it's sad. Loved the guy. I live in Portland, Oregon, and Paul lived up in Bellingham, which is about an hour north of Seattle. So about 4 hours away, but we'd meet for Seahawk games. His wife and my wife and me, he'd come through Portland every once in a while. I visited once when we went up to Bellingham. But I met him on the CU boards originally, just absolutely loved his sense of humor, and I immediately migrated to that as I have the same sick sense of humor. Before I joined LTS, before I joined, you know, VFC, I met Paul. I mean, I went to a national before I had any of that in August of 2008. And I'd arranged to meet Paul, and I met him outside the Chicago National, and he was smoking, and met Rick Snyder there with Mint State as well, and the three of us sat and talked, and we went and had lunch. So Paul's, you know, the first hobby person I met, and I dug him. Did a lot of things socially with him, you know, drinks. We both loved gin, Hendrick's gin. Went golfing with him at a national. Kurt Schmigdahl shared some pictures. I totally forgot about that. I have the guy named Vince Bellier, who's from Australia. And Kurt, me and Paul, we all went golfing. And Paul's just that funny guy. I mean, he broke his driver at one point and had the sprinklers go on him and just laughed and just had a good time. And that's what Paul brought to the table, and loved his sense of humor. And I knew he wasn't well. He visited Portland about 4 years ago, about a year before COVID, and we all went to dinner and had some drinks, and I knew he wasn't well then. He'd announced then he had Parkinson's, the onset of it, and he wasn't showing very much. So, I mean, I was like, hopefully this is one of those slow-moving ones, you know, and he'll get better, or he'll be able to live with it somehow. I hadn't spoken to him in 2.5 years, you know, through the pandemic, and, you know, that we all get busy, and going to miss the guy. Wolfie, man, love you. And I hope your 62 Fleer set is waiting for you in heaven, my man.
Yeah, I agree. Great person for the hobby, great sense of humor. Had a lot of good laughs with him, had a lot of good times. Last time I saw him was the last National, I believe, in Chicago. And I remember dinner with him again. And then my infamous trip in 2016, helping him get home that night. R.I.P. Paul. We miss you, guys. All right. Onward. Auctions. Joe, handing off to you.
Well, thanks for allowing me to segue from that into this. We're going to talk about some auctions that popped out. I mentioned in the last show, I get giddy during auction season. And we had Memory Lane was ending, but there were some ho-hum things in Memory Lane. And I knew Mile High had some really good Mile High had some good things coming up, as well as REA. And there's one more that pops here in a little bit, but I wanted to talk about the one that goes first here, Mile High. Pretty happy. Some, as you know, I've gotten more and more into my unopened collection a little bit, and just saw this 59 Topps vending box, where you remember where the cards were banded together as, and the quote was, as if one would do currency. That box has resurfaced.
I saw that.
So I don't know if it's the same. How many 59 vending boxes are there out there? You know,
exactly.
I don't know. But
exactly.
But a first series a vending box, two of them, 1959, are up for sale. They end in 7 days. Currently at 20,000, not including the VIG. And then a partial box of 59 vending, approximately 238 cards, would be about 15 packs. Also there, pretty interesting. And then a 1960 Topps partial vending box, unsearched, 315 cards, which is about 16 packs. So vending, and again, they show pictures of the boxes, and the two vending box one, you can see a discoloration of the cards at some point. They go the other way and they're slightly discolored. And I just look at this and I'm like, and one of them, the picture, we call it vending box A, you can see a riffle in a couple of the cards in the center packs, which means they've been taken out and dropped or something like that. And it's just vending boxes, Bob. I mean, the odds of these things being searched, thumbed through, pretty high. You know?
Yeah, I don't see what the fascination with these two boxes are, number one and number two. I think they're picked over and damaged. And I don't know who in their right mind really wants to, bid on something like that, knowing the condition it's in. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. So, it is what it is. Good luck to anybody who's buying it. You obviously got a lot of money to burn if you're going to put your money into something like that. But to me, they're not worth it. They really aren't.
Yep. So two boxes of full 59 vending. One of the boxes looks like it's been picked through. One box of 59 vending that's partial. One box of 60 vending that's partial. A lot of this vending hitting the road. I don't know why it's coming out of the woodwork, but I love, unopened, but I'm certainly not going to buy a vending box. I don't even like modern vending boxes, but just the possibility, the odds of them being picked through, are just too much. So that's a cool one, Mile High. Very happy with that. Robert Edward Auction, friend of Gridiron Greats podcast, Brian Durant Brian Dwyer was on, about a year ago? 10 months ago?
Yep.
I love seeing his auctions pop. I love seeing him get amazing things. Great unopened. A third series 72 football, which we know the third series is incredibly rare. Doesn't come up very much.
Right.
77 football with the superstar Seahawk great Steve Largent rookie card in there. An amazing SGC 8.5 Jim Brown rookie card. and then also a stunning 58 Jim Brown PSA 8 that is just good looking. A good sampling of 57 tops, a really good sampling of 35 Chickle minus the Nagurski. You can never find a Nagurski. I haven't seen one of those come up for auction in a long time, but really good unopened. I love seeing a really good auction like this pop where there's about, you know, 25 things you put a feeler bid on and you're hoping to end up with about three or four of them. You're hoping some stuff falls through the cracks, but absolutely stunning, good-looking Jim Brown rookie cards.
And I got a feeling those Brown rookie cards are going to really go through the roof because of just the high appeal to each one of them. They're nice cards. Those are generally nice cards. And again, because you know me, I like picking on graded cards because I don't collect them.
Yeah.
Why is it an 8.5? It's beyond me. I don't get it. I don't understand the rationale behind grading cards. I will never understand it. And that's it. my opinion, that should be a 9. You know, it presents well. You know, what's the game of it? What's the point of it? Just to crack it open and get it regraded and say you can regrade it? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. It really doesn't. It does not make sense to me. But,
whatever. It is a game. And then an auction I've been waiting to open. Memory Lane just popped. They gave a really nice preview, which I always appreciate. And inside this is a VFC member had mentioned he had a 52 Bowman large nickel pack, incredibly rare, that he was auctioning off in this. So you have an incredibly rare nickel pack, and you have a partial box of 54 Bowman nickel packs. That is 14 of the original 24 packs. But I'm really glad they put a picture in here because if you look at the picture, some of the packs look like they have some damage to them, you know.
Right,
so it's nice to see that picture too. That, you know, to post up a little bit, you know, a little bit better of a description. But so partial nickel pack wax box, which is pretty cool.
Some great items coming up, and I can only imagine again where that unopened ends up at, how high it goes.
Yeah,
it'd be amazing, truly amazing.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep our audience. Go ahead.
Yep, I was just going to say, and then obviously Heritage, I think, has a continually running auction every 30 days. So, the usual.
Yeah, exactly. And Love of the Game had an auction, but there was no football in it. It's his baseball spring training auction. Not spring training, but spring auction. And I know he normally just has only baseball in it. I looked at it. And it was all baseball. So we'll see what happens for the next few weeks. We'll keep everybody posted on this. Some great material.
Not a single large in card net auction. Disappointing.
our special guest is here, and I'd like to introduce him. He's been a pro football writer for over 30 years, starting at the Pitt News, the University of Pittsburgh student newspaper, where he won the school's first Outstanding Sports Columnist Award. He's been a member of the Pro Football Writers Association since 1987. He joined Pro Football Weekly in 2004, where he was a featured columnist through 2013. At Pro Football Weekly, he won several PFWA Writing Awards, including Best Column, the most coveted of all awards in 2009. I'd like to welcome to the show this evening Mr. Tom Danilek. Tom! Welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you. I've been anticipating this interview all day.
Hey, me too. What a coincidence.
looking forward to it. I liked some of the topics that I got to see in the prep sheet. So I'm ready to roll.
Most excited guest award, right, Bob? I like it.
You got it. You got it. And again, when I was introduced to you via email by John Wilkie, it was interesting when I saw University of Pittsburgh brought back some fond memories from me before your time, however, in 80, 81, and 82. I had dated a gal there who was, I went to college with as an undergraduate. She did her graduate work there. I never saw a Pitt football game, though, while I was there. But it was interesting. Nice campus
years.
There. Yeah, I know. I know. I was not able to get out there on a weekend they were playing at home. So very interesting. But welcome to the show, Tom. And I'd like to lead off by asking you, and if you could tell our audience, how did you get interested in football and in your initial writings at the University of Pittsburgh there?
Yeah, well, football, that just happened when I realized I was on the planet. And there was the NBC games on in the 70s and the music and the great uniforms and the Kurt Gowdy's voice and Summerall and all that. So I was drawn to that. I don't remember ever not being a fan, put it that way. I think most people can relate to the same thing. The writing part of it came, I'd say, to you through Sports Illustrated, which you guys know that there was Sporting News and Sports Illustrated, and then you waited another week till they came out again, right? That was sports. That's all you got. And the picture, the combination of great photography and great writing, which at that time Sports Illustrated had, even through into the early 90s, was just, you know, it was an event for me when that magazine came out. So that's part of the link. And then growing up where I did in Western Pennsylvania, this was a great time for Pittsburgh sports writers. The Post-Gazette and the Press were just loaded with great columnists back then, entertaining guys. And so I was drawn to that world, although I didn't care about writing it. I just wanted to read it. But then when I got to Pitt in 85, I picked up a copy of the school newspaper, and I read their pro football or their college football preview, and I thought, wow, you know, geez, I can do better than this. Even though I wasn't sure if I could do better than this, I said I could do better than this, and so I jumped into it, and that's how I got caught up with the pairing of writing and football, mostly pro football.
Huh. Well, I remember those Sports Illustrated showing up. You were talking about that, Tom, and I'm like, man, I can remember the smell of the magazine, the excitement of it, just reading it, and just the writing was so good. And that's, you know, obviously pre-internet, et cetera.
Well, plus, you know, it was a big deal to see who was going to be on the cover. I mean, that was an event.
Right.
I mean, it really was.
Good point. Good, very good point.
You know, the same thing with the Sporting News. What was overlooked in the Sporting News, in my opinion, it had the most complete statistics of the four team sports every week. And, you know, you just couldn't beat it. I mean, you had a breakdown of your football scores. You had your breakdown of your baseball, but had every box score of every major league game. I mean, it was just a wealth of knowledge there that is, to me, it's not found today. Even on the internet, it's really not found. Yeah, you still see box scores. You still have, breakdown scores on football games, so on and so forth. But you just don't have that flavor that you had in a printed publication like a Sports Illustrated or a Sporting News or even Sport Magazine where you read that kind of stuff. So it's really a lost art, to say the least.
But, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. Every week was a weekly, you know, I always look forward to, and I subscribed to Sports Illustrated back in the 60s, you know, up to roughly the 90s, and Sporting News I subscribed in the late 60s up to the 90s also, and it was just an incredible publication, to say the least.
Tom, I feel like we would be good friends if we had met earlier. Yeah, all the things you write about, the era you write about, is right in my sweet spot when I was growing up. Like you mentioned, you said earlier, it's like I don't ever remember not being a football fan, and that really resonated with me because I'm the exact same way. Your book, Majesty and Mayhem, Pro Football of the 1980s, the probably one of the best era footballs, or football, everyone's going to talk, you know, point to a different one, but That's when I got into football. That's when, you know, it became popular on TV. Tell us about your book and how you came to write it.
Yeah, well, I had my first book was on the 70s, and it was a basically a collection of Playboy magazine type interviews. You know, I just took a copy of a Playboy interview and said, okay, I'm going to write these football interviews all in the same style. So really, not a lot of creative or editorial type writing for that one. It's mostly just sitting down, listening to a tape recorder and transcribing. The next one I did was a book on the 60s, a fictional book about pro football, had the AFL and NFL got together 5 years earlier and had five more Super Bowls. And so I got to play with that one a lot, loose with the facts, because I could make it all up and nobody could, you know, contradict me or call me out on it, because it's all fiction. Well, then all of a sudden it becomes this logical progression. Okay, well, what's the next era you want to look at? In the 80s, really – you know, my favorite era, only because I remember it from start to finish. You know, in the 70s, I couldn't tell you what happened between 70 and 73, but 80 to 89, I mean, I'm on that. So that was really an easy one for me to address, because I was, you know, dialed in every Sunday and very familiar with all the characters and the games and the coaches, et cetera, et cetera. So the way I handled this one was not so much a chronological history, Michael McCambridge type presentation. I just said, okay, what do you recall from the 80s? What were your favorite moments, your favorite games, the most controversial topics? And I just pulled them out of my head and wrote basically an essay on each one of those 45 topics, and they're all 80s focused, and that became Majesty and Mayhem.
Huh. I beg your pardon. I didn't have time to order and read the book. So this is kind of a novella. It's a bunch of short stories on different topics, basically.
Yeah, I like that short chapter feel, because then you can put it down and you can go away and pick it up 3 weeks later and not forget where you were. I like that snapshot type of book.
That's unique to write it that way, too, because I think especially a lot of football books, to say the least, are very regimentated as far as how they're covering things and how they write things. You know what I mean? And, looking at your, some of the online stuff of your book, so on and so forth, it is something that you can read and then put it down and then pick it back up again. And you're not lost as far as, well, what was spoken about this player, this game, so on and so forth. And again, in a way, how much can you write about something that has been written about 100 times, 1,000 times over and over again? And that's something, if you're looking for a better niche, a more unique niche, you really found it in writing it that way. That's the way I look at it.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, let's be honest. What can anybody learn about Marino or Fouts or the 85 Bears or Lawrence Tett, right? So you can't start just regurgitating what's already out there. You've got to present a little different angle to these characters. And that's what I tried to do here, because, first of all, my impressions on them, and I'm not trying to necessarily give a historical resume with these people. My memories of it, what I think about them, and maybe you disagree, which is good, because at least I'm stirring some kind of emotion in the book rather than people just saying, okay, well, I knew 9 of the 10 things you presented here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and then I think that's what's unique about it, because again, I have hundreds of football books, and especially the newer stuff that's coming out. There's certain ones about older players, from like the 20s and 30s. You are learning something new because there really isn't that much information. You're right in what you're saying. What really I look at basically from 1970 up, what hasn't not been written about a player or game or a season that has not been written already? What is different? What is unique? What more can you add? I'd rather read, this is from my point of view, I'd rather read what happened to the player after he stopped playing, what did he do, what are his recollections of the game, what was his insight. That's more interesting to me than just the regurgitation of, the 1976 Super Bowl type of thing. So where you have a nice niche there as far as what you wrote making it a little more interesting than just the run-of-the-mill 1980s stuff, you know. And you're right. What more do you want to learn about Dan Marino? What more can be written about him, you know? Very true.
And yeah, exactly.
Along those same lines, I was always a big fan of Pro Football Weekly, the newspaper. And I started reading that when I actually found a copy of it in the late 60s. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think they started publishing in 1967. And it was a weekly pro football newspaper. And it had a lot of nice columns, a lot of inside information. It was very interesting to read. And I know, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, it was roughly 2013, 2014 when you stopped writing for them. They were having a lot of financial difficulty. And I guess that's when they ceased the actual printed copy of Pro Football Weekly. But I was always a big fan of Pro Football Weekly. So I'm interested. Tell us about how you and what you wrote for them. And you were there for quite a while also, almost 10 years.
Yeah, they were kind enough to give me pretty much a blank check on what columns I wanted to write. I was basically a columnist. And they said, okay, hey, you know, do what you want. Very little editing, very little, you know, changing the content. I had a lot of connections around the league. They had a lot of connections around the league that I could play off of. So I was able to get a lot of good, you know, Art Rooney Jr. and, you know, Paul Zimmerman from Sportsville and just dial into people like that. So the problem was with Pro Football Weekly was, you know, as you know, print started dying, what, mid-2000s, you know, magazines.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Pro Football Weekly was no longer a niche item because the whole internet was flooded with pro football stuff. And by the way, Pro Football Weekly charged and the other folks didn't. And then the fantasy stuff took over big and Pro Football Weekly wanted to remain, you know, purist. We're going to talk about the game and its people, not get into the statistics. They refused to do that. And so it died a slow death, and I'm sad to see it go, but I really thought the brand name would carry some weight into the internet world, into the PDF world. It did not. It did not. And unfortunately, I lost my venue.
Hmm. And you wrote most of your articles kind of in the format that you said you used to copy out of SI, that you emulated?
Not so much SI, but more of a column. You know, just it wasn't, I didn't do a lot of hard research with this stuff. I would watch a game or see some kind of event, and that was treated as a pure columnist. So that's what I enjoyed. I don't want to, game stories are boring to me. I mean, you can jazz them up. You can have some fun with them and color them up a little bit with, you know, some unique wording, but they're boring to me. So, yeah, so I was considered a feature columnist there, and that was really my dream job when it came to what I was looking to do as a writer.
Tom, you mentioned
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, I still maintain, contrary to, you know, what a lot of people say, there's still a market for a printed publication. And, you know, not everybody, contrary to what everybody believes that everybody gets all their information off the internet and that's it. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, there can be room for, to me, a good printed publication for sports. And for, you know, a stronger sense of journalism and writing of these articles and columns and so on and so forth than the stuff that's being, you know, depending on who you read and where you read it, so on and so forth, than what you get. I mean, if you read Sports Illustrated lately, it's a monthly publication now, and they have like three or four long articles and that's it, in-depth articles. And I don't even see why they're publishing anymore. Although some articles are actually interesting. They're not. There's nothing there. You know what I mean? I'm not going to run to my newsstand and buy a Sports Illustrated just because of those articles type of them. But
no, I think the Athletic kind of cornered that right now. Isn't it called The Athletic, where they went out and paid all the best top columnists around the country to be their writers? And then you got to pay like 29 bucks a month or something for that. But SI let itself collapse. But that's a whole different ballgame. I just don't know if the generations, the kids that grew up in the 90s and the 2000s and the 2010s, I don't know if print means anything to them. I don't think it does. And I think the longer we go on, print's going to continue just to shrivel up. I mean, I used to love coming home and printing off Dr. Z's article and having that piece of paper in my hand and reading it off. I don't know how many people in their 30s and 20s and teens can relate to that feeling.
Right.
Tom, you know Bob is the publisher of Gridiron Greats magazine, right?
Yeah.
So we're
yeah,
a little
I'm aware.
Bit
I'm, just, I'm just I'm just telling you what I see out there. You know, I mean, my nephew, a big sports fan allegedly, but he's never even looked at one of my books, you know. So
yeah, I'm just kidding. I love getting the Gridiron Greats. I think a little bit of it's nostalgic. I mean, we grew up with that. It takes us back to our yesteryears to get a publication, to open it, to read it, the feel of the paper, the smell of the ink, all of it.
The
if photos. You haven't done that, then. So you mentioned your book, you know, it comprised of, I think you said, 45 short stories.
45 individual chapters.
I'm about to ask you which of your children is your favorite, but while you're writing these chapters, there have to be some topics that you're more passionate about than others that are excited. I mean, tell us some stories about when writing some of these and just how you pick the topics.
Well, how I picked the topics, again, it was just whatever. When I look back in my mind's eye at that decade, what excited me or what intrigued me, what did I dislike about that era? So I'll give you a couple examples here quite easily. The number one of the first ones I wrote, although it's not chronological in the book, is about the early 80s Jets. And anybody that paid attention to the Jets, 80, 81, 82, 83. You heard it even from Cosell on Monday night, the most talented roster in football, but it never went anywhere. You know, they got to the championship game in 82, and it died. So I tracked down the personnel director, the guy that handled all their drafts in those years, a guy named Mike Hickey, Red Hickey's son. You know, the former, I guess, UCLA coach or 49ers coach or whoever. And He had left football in 89 when the Jets canned him, and he went into financial management and just basically stopped doing any interviews, and I had a heck of a time tracking him down, but I did. And for some reason, he, you know, agreed to talk to me about those Jets teams and why they failed, why after 82 it all died. And, you know, he went into and some stuff I didn't even bother putting in the book because he told me not to. But with a problem with Walt Michaels, a problem with Joe Walton when he took over, his relationship with the players, the issues with Richard Todd, why they didn't draft Marino. You know, why not take Marino? And I will tell you this because it's not going to spoil the rest of the book, but they painted themselves into a corner of the Jets, and I call it, you know, catch 22. Remember the thing, you don't go on bombing missions because you're crazy, but only people that are staying say that they don't want to go on bombing missions, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I call it catch 13 with Marino, and Hickey explained to me very carefully. He goes, we are all set to draft Dan Marino if he's available. So he's ticking off, and he's still there. And then he said the Steelers got to him. And they said, well, we're absolutely 100% sure the Steelers are going to take him, and forget about it. We'll start looking at who our next choice is going to be. And the Steelers didn't take him. So instead of jumping on Marino, the Jets' thought process became, wait a minute, if the Steelers didn't take him, well, there must be something wrong with him, so now we're not going to take him. And this is Hickey. Yeah, and Hickey's like, we outthought ourselves with this guy.
Oh, wow.
So I said, there's no way you can take him. If Pittsburgh gets him, you can't have him. And if Pittsburgh doesn't take him, you're not going to take him. So it was very strange. But, you know, it just tells you how puzzling a player Marino was, because there were those drug rumors about him that you know, I've talked to a number of personnel people, and they, you know, some say yes, indeed true. Others say no. But the rumors were there. And the Jets figured if Pittsburgh passed on this guy, because you know they were Bradshaw had left, and you know Malone and Stout weren't really going to be big time guys there. And that when they didn't take him, they figured, well, there's got to be something true to these rumors, so we're not going to take him. So I thought that was really the first time I saw it in print. I mean, I've not seen it anywhere, and I researched, you know, Hickey before, you know, calling him. I didn't see that. Couldn't find it anywhere.
Boy, Marino was a Pitt guy. He went Pitt. I mean, that's – I didn't know that.
Right in the backyard. I just know
right
in the backyard, so, yeah. Yeah.
When was Gastineau and Flacco part of that team? I always heard there were problems between Gastineau and Flacco too.
Mike Hickey confirmed that, but he said it didn't really affect the defense. I mean, Klecko didn't like the showboating. You know, the inside guys could eat up all the blocking, and then, you know, Gastineau gets to swarm in on a one-on-one situation. But if you look at the sackings that were done during that era, it didn't really – the relationship or the dislike between the two didn't really affect their performance. And it wasn't just Klecko that didn't like Gas. I don't think Marty Lyons had much for him, and I don't think the offensive guys liked that either.
Gotcha. Okay.
Strange bird.
Other Lyons, stories, and I apologize. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Marty Lyons had a nice career as a commentator for the Jets over the years, and when I lived in Connecticut, obviously it was the Jets, Giants, Patriots all the time, and I listened to him a lot, and he was a very good broadcaster. But thinking back to those 80 to 82, 83 teams, you're right. They had a lot of talent, and they could never win the big game. And it was, you know, they still can't win the big game, you know, and it's just amazing. A franchise to go that many years doing nothing. I mean, really, that's what it amounts to. And now looking at Rodgers being their savior, which he's not going to be, a lot of money is going to be wasted again, and for what? I'm not going to do anything with them. Whatever.
Yeah, they seem to think that they've got a Super Bowl ready team with just one guy. I don't see them being this extremely talented bunch. But if they can bring him in for 2 years, you could roll the dice, and it's going to at least put excitement back in the building.
Right. Exactly.
Hmm.
Any
other stories?
What
are some other
stories,
Tom? You were mentioning something.
Oh yeah. You talked about the different topics about that. They're interesting to me. And I thought another one was when I was at Pro Football Weekly. I had talked to John Shula, and yeah, he was pretty open about all the topics I was presenting to him. And he said to me, "There's absolutely, had we beaten the Patriots in the 85 playoffs or the championship, we would have beaten the Bears again in a rematch." Adamantly. They couldn't match up with us. You know, Marino's release, track, fast track, our receivers versus their defensive back. You know, I'm pretty adamant about it. So when I'm doing the 85 Bears section, I didn't want to tell you about anything that you already knew. I went in there and I found a couple of ex-Bears and I presented to them what Shula had said, and I said, okay, tell me why that would not have happened, why you would have beat Miami. Gary Fencik and, who's the defensive coach up in Buffalo? He was a D-back for them. Leslie Frazier. Yeah. So I tracked those two guys down and said, okay, tell me why Shula's wrong. And that got them animated. Now they're talking about, oh, really? You guys lost to New England? You're going to beat us in a rematch? And, you know, so they broke it down technically, too, what they would have done differently in a rematch with Marino, how they would have handled him. And that was another interesting thing to me when I was putting the book together. An interesting topic, I'll say.
I don't think anybody would have beaten the Bears that year. I really don't. I cannot see that. The Bears were the Bears. I mean, they were unstoppable that year. No way. I can't see Miami in a rematch beating them. And the Patriots, to me, were just so overmatched, it wasn't even funny. So, yeah, they had a good team, but there's no possible way they had a good enough team to beat the Bears that year. But
yeah,
interesting,
twice.
Though.
I agreed. But listen, it gave me something to put my teeth into, right?
Totally.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what you're looking for. So, and again, I wonder how many coaches second-guess themselves as the years go on. What happens if we did this? What happens if we did that? So on and so forth. We could have won here. We could have won there. Blah, blah, blah. And like I always say, you know, football is a simplistic game. You got to have more points than the other team and you win the game. That's what it's all about. So you got to fight for every point. You got to fight for every score. You're doing analytical. You know, today to me, it's much more analytical and it's more statistic, I don't know what the word I'm trying to use. It's just more focused on the metrics of this play is going to work 90% of the time, so we're going to run it. Even though I know Joe Schmo on the corner there is going to come in and kill us, I'm going to still run the play type of thing. You know, instead of using any type of real football sense, and that's what I really think is missing in the game. There's just not a lot of common sense on the field and play calling in a lot of cases. Let the players play. That's the way I look at it. You know, but it is what it is. It's overcoached, to say the least. But
yeah, you're absolutely right about that. The minutiae becomes very, very prevalent.
Very important,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Another question for you, Tom. Joe and I are football collectors. Do you collect anything? Or are you, any Pittsburgh memorabilia, NFL memorabilia, whatever it may be?
The main thing I got into was AJD caps from the 70s. You recall those? They had the mesh backing, and they had the AJD was the name of the company. They had Lucky Stripes and Super Stripes, and in sports, so they always had the picture of the four or five hats arrayed out there, and just if you can't Google that, and you'll see them. But that's what I collect because number one, wasn't allowed to have any when I was growing up. And number two, if I could get a hold of one, it wasn't any of the teams I was interested in. So that I collected those to the point where I go, okay, now what? I got all the teams I want. I only have one head. I can only wear one at a time. So I burned that passion out. But it took 10 years of my time to do it.
Cool. So I've never heard of them, but I wrote it down and I'll look that up. How'd you get into collecting
AJD's,
that?
I'm sorry?
How'd you get into collecting those? Just your era?
I just thought they were cool. I just liked the way they looked. I mean, if you remember in the 70s, people wore the caps up on top of their head. They didn't really pull them down, you know? It just sat on top of your head like that. And
oh,
I was stupid in a hat. Anyway.
Were those the ones that had the stripes in the front and they had, like, the logo in the middle? And then the other half. Oh, okay. And it was like some of them had a mesh in the back of your head on the hat, and some were full caps. I vaguely remember those now. I can picture them. Those were pretty cool. Those were definitely cool. I had a couple, but I don't remember.
They had Patriots one too. So. Yeah, so they had Lucky Stripes and Super Stripes, what they call them. So the first ones, the stripes went parallel to the ground, and the other ones were vertical. But anyway,
that's my collection. Okay.
Tom, it's so funny you talk about like Dan Marino and those, and I mean, you know, Bob mentioned we're collectors, and there's so many, like cards. Like I know Dan Marino's drafted in '83, his rookie card's '84. And I know that because I'm an avid 1984 collector, and there's so many of these players and names and stuff and teams and position, what number they are, that I associate with collecting. I know where Marino and Elway's card is located on the Series C sheet of the 84 top set, where he was drafted from, because I remember looking at that Marino card a lot when I was a kid. That's just kind of my mnemonic, my memory of, you know, the collecting is associated with the player and, you know, the team.
Yeah, that's a very big thing, the cards and the – I don't know if if it's still as big in terms of the newer stuff, because I used to collect stuff myself,
yeah.
more just for personal gratification, not for necessarily increasing value and that sort of thing. I just liked having the dolphin
yeah.
cards and the stars and all that. But, yeah, but that hat thing was
yeah.
number one for me in terms of being a pure collector and trying to track this stuff down at garage sales, and eBay helped a lot.
Without a doubt.
Cool.
Your book, Majesty and Mayhem, Pro Football of the 1980s. Can you tell our listeners where they can find your book and how to purchase it?
Yes, sir. Amazon.com, right
I've
there.
I've heard of that.
About as, about as
that.
Easy as it gets. The only
yeah.
And the funny thing is, like, I can't even tell you any bookstores where you might find it because I don't think bookstores exist anymore.
There are
Portland is very famous for one very huge bookstore called Powell's Books. It's an entire city block, 40,000 square feet with a couple sub-basements and stuff. So it's got a coffee shop in it. I love going down there and grabbing books and going into the coffee shop. So,
hey, we're
yeah.
old school that way. I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Very good point. So, well, I look forward to it. I have it in my queue to order, and I look forward to it. I especially love... Like you said, the little stories like that, the a collection of stories that you can start, stop, you know, et cetera. I look forward to it, especially since it seems like we're from the same era. So,
just to let you guys know, I started a 1990s version yesterday. So give me 2 years
oh,
and I'll
cool.
have a 90s version out for you.
Cool.
All right. One well, last sure. question, Tom. Our listeners really want to know. Any of your stories revolve around the Seattle Seahawks great wide receiver, Steve Largent?
Unfortunately, they do not. But I will say this. In the 70s book that I did, the Super 70s, I did a whole chapter with Jack Patera.
Oh, wow.
Who was always known for being a very quiet guy, but boy, he talked away from
yep.
when I was talking to him. So, yeah, I did a chapter on Patera, who I thought did a hell of a job when the Hawks first came into existence.
Absolutely.
I wanted to make sure he was part of that book.
That's
wow.
really cool.
Cool.
How do you get a hold of people? Like, how do you find people to just even reach out to Jack Patera?
That's a great question. Well, the Internet really help because prior to the Internet, you know, how did you track people down? There really was no thing. But now you can at least find out what city they live. Okay, then you kind of try to find out if they're associated with some kind of church group or something like that. It's a lot easier now. The problem I have with doing this writing today is that the farther we get into history, so like the 1990s is going to be tough to get people to talk to me because the media really exploded during that decade. The Internet exploded. People want to keep their own content for their own websites and things. So I find it much more reluctant to get interviews versus the 70s where those guys are thinking half of them were forgotten and they're very willing to talk. And with Patera, again, known for being a quiet guy when he was the Seahawks coach, boy, I could have talked to him for another 3 hours, and the chapter would have been too long. But, yeah, that's my Seattle participation in the three books I've done.
That's very cool. Yeah. Patera played at Oregon, University of Oregon up here in Oregon.
That I did not know.
Player.
Very interesting. And you're right. I think the older guys do like to have their story told. I know we feature a lot of older players in our magazine, and they're happy to talk again about their playing days, so on and so forth. Newer guys, it's hit or missing a lot. There's still some great guys playing the game. But to me, you know, you got to find them, and you got to build their trust with them, and then they're happy to talk about things. So that's great. That's very interesting. Tom, thanks for being on today. I appreciate it. And hopefully
sell
some more books. And
well,
very
I appreciate
interesting.
It. I really enjoyed this.
I'm glad. It's interesting. It's refreshing to hear something different being written as you
totally.
Did with your book. And I wish you the best with your new book in the 90s. And we'll have you back on when you're finished with that. We'll talk about that. How's that sound?
Very good. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Tom,
okay.
great
Thanks
having
for
you
on
the cast. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Joe, we're going to go into, we got a couple extra minutes today going into our two-minute warning a little early. But, again, that's pretty interesting. And I think he brought up a couple of good points. And like I said in the show, and I really mean it, what else can be written about certain things? You know what I'm saying? And I try to look at things differently. And now, again, we both like older football history.
Yeah.
Our history basically starts in the 20s and prior to that, and it doesn't end really until like the 70s or the 80s. And, you know, in the 90s, the 00s, the 10s, the 20s, the history is there. But what can be written about it? What can you say? You know, what can be written? I'd like to read a story one day or a book one day, getting into Belichick's mind as a coach, how he made his determinations the way he did to coach the way he did. I think that would be an interesting book. You know what I mean? Is it be written? Is it going to be, you know, is anything he's going to say not been said already? That's the point of it. So interesting.
I read a lot of books on American history, you know, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, et cetera. And I can tell you I have probably a dozen books on James Madison. And I'm reading a book right now, The Letters Between, which is just literally the letters between Madison and Jefferson that they wrote. They were extensive writers. And every book opens another door. Every point of view is a little bit different. And the more you read on a topic, the better. I mean, our last show's guest, Joe Ziamba, I believe is how it's pronounced, the Chicago Cardinals, Chicago Bears. I thought I knew a lot about the Bears. Reading his book, I learned a lot. I really wish I would have had a chance to order his book and get it and read it in time. I have two books working right now, the Jefferson Madison letters. And then I just finished, the Cardinals Bears, book a couple days ago over the weekend. I would love to read his story. Cause I mean, just different points of view on the same subject, I think are fascinating. And I've also put books away where it's just, all right, it's a little belabored, it's the same point of view, and put them away. But I can tell by Tom's style, he was so excitable. I mean, shot right out of the gate. You know, when you introduced him, you're like, oh, my gosh, I love this energy. I can just tell that plays over to his writing because he was very excited about it. How do you find the time to read all the books that suggested to you? Because you're a prolific football
fan. I'm always reading. It drives Brenda crazy because I'm reading three different books at the same time.
Yeah,
and she always says,
totally.
How can you keep track of this stuff? And then she says, you're going to do a review on this. What are you doing? And for me, I have a notebook. I still physically write down notes on books and stuff like that. And I do write in books. And, it just keeps me, keeps me fresh with the book in trying to read it. So on and so forth. I have the PDF version of Joe's book from our last show, and I'm reading that. And PDF books for me are a little more difficult to read for the simple reason I've got to go online all the time to do it. I read it on my phone sometimes. So anyways, long story short, I'm reading various books at the same time. And like you, I know the books that are sleepers, and I know the books that keep my interest, and that's what it's all about. And you try to find some. Got to try to find something in that book that keeps you wanting to finish reading the book. And that's an art to doing that, to say the least. And we're almost out of time. 10 seconds, Joe. Any other final thoughts?
Great guest. I loved his energy. Good show, Bob.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I'm glad our mutual friend John Wilkie gave us the information on him, and we got to talk to him. That's it.
Yeah.
Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. If you're not a subscriber, what are you waiting for? And we'll be back hopefully in another week or so with another show. Take care.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.